This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails go to talk@talklouisiana.org. Our show is underwritten as a signature sponsor by the Office of East Baton Rouge Parish Mayor President Sharon Weston Broom, and it originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. This is now the midway point of our spring pledge drive, and we want to increase our membership roles if possible. It's always nice if you're a listener who has been on the sidelines to join the family, and you can do so now by calling 855-893-9753 or go to wrkf.org. And you can support WRKF right now with a gift of $2 a month. You can give more if you like, $5, $10, $15, but if you do $2 a month, you can be a member of WRKF. So we want you to be part of the family, and it is the $2 Tuesday special, Barbara Clark tells me. So there we go, 855-893-9753. We start with one of our favorite guests, Dr. Jeff Satto at LSU Shreveport, who, of course, speaks from the conservative side of the spectrum, and he is a person who I think represents the majority of Louisiana citizens when it comes to the politics of our state. And we have a super conservative in Jeffrey Martin Landry as governor of Louisiana, and we are now 100 days into the Landry administration. And good morning to you, Dr. Satto.
Good morning, Jim.
Your thoughts about where we are with Governor Jeff Landry?
Yeah, well, when Governor Landry got into office, he spoke of if you're way behind, you have to really run hard to catch up, and he's been doing his best and the legislature to run hard to catch up to what he thinks are the necessary priorities and needs of the state.
Well, he's had a busy 100 days, and he's not letting up. We may have a constitutional convention. Are you even you surprised, Jeff Satto, at the amount of change that he is endeavoring to make in the early going?
I'm not sure about that because one of the kind of rules of thumb that are thought of for executives in terms of success when they're in office is. There are several things, but a couple that are really relevant here. One being that if you have a big majority, then go for big changes. And then another being 4 or 8 or how many ever years may seem to be a lot of time, but it's not. So you've got to get going and start quickly. And Landry seems to be following those rules. He's putting a lot of stuff out there. He's trying to move on a lot of stuff. So, yes, it's a lot, but, if you want to be a successful chief executive, that's the kind of thing you need to do. So in one sense, I'm maybe a little surprised that so much is being done so quickly. But, then again, you look at those rules for success, and he's trying to follow them.
Well, it was President Obama who said elections have consequences, and it is apparent that Jeff Landry wants to undo much of what John Bel Edwards did, just short of trying to go back to no Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. But he hasn't done that and says he won't, but he's tweaked just about everything else or tried to, and he's not stopping. He's not resting on his laurels, and he's got a largely compliant legislature. What do you view so far as the most substantial change that is in the offing?
Well, I mean, certainly, if we look at what happened in the special session, one of the special sessions, the near total unraveling of the criminal justice changes that occurred under Edwards, although maybe that's a little old news, but the thing that he's, I think, really focusing on now, one thing you mentioned, the Constitutional Convention, which is really, I'm not sure that it's that ideological or partisan an issue, because there seems to be a large consensus across the board that the current Constitution is just unwieldy in its coverage and its rigidity. So the idea and the idea that he's fronting here is that we really don't go in and make changes to the policy aspects of the Constitution, but rather you just put it on this huge diet and you move a lot of stuff into statute, and then later go back and, you know, if you want to change what's now statute, then go ahead and do it. It'd be a lot easier to do it in any event. So I don't know that it's that partisan of an issue that there should be change to the Constitution. And really the format that he's suggesting is that there really wouldn't be much in the way of partisan change. The real battles, of course, would happen next year or beyond, when the things that were evicted from the Constitution, if that's what ends up happening, that's when you might see ideological and partisan battles over those kinds of things. But that idea is, somewhat revolutionary. I mean, we're talking about massive changes to the Constitution, but at the same time, not really that revolutionary, since pretty much everything's going to be that was in the Constitution is going to be in statute, and things would still be going on pretty much as they were.
Well, we'll see if that happens. And of course, Cameron Henry says if it does, they got to be out by June 3rd, which means they'd have a long way to go in a short time to get there. But the social issues, the governor has not abandoned. I think many thought he would be a, quote, culture warrior, and that he is. And today, The Advocate, in its editorial page, opines that libraries don't belong on a list of state problems. The newspaper's editorial reads, Louisiana's got some big problems that demand the legislature's attention, from unaffordable property insurance to crippling out-migration to dilapidated infrastructure. You know what's not a big problem? What's going on at local libraries, writes The Advocate. And some lawmakers have put the state's librarians in their crosshairs. It's all part of a misguided movement, continues the newspaper, led by a loud but limited minority to police what kids can read, which has gained a foothold in places like Lafayette, Livingston, and St. Tammany. Two bills on the subject are scheduled to be heard before the House Criminal Justice Committee today. House Bill 414 by Josh Carlson of Lafayette and House Bill 545 by Beryl Amity of Houma would amend the state's obscenity law to remove libraries and school libraries from a list of exempt places that includes government agencies, churches, museums, hospitals, and recognized and established schools, a category that would no longer include public K-12 schools under the proposed rewrite. These proposals would expose librarians to fines and up to 3 years in prison if they did not comply. So there we are with libraries being part of the mix here. And we do have, as I think Dr. Sato, you would acknowledge, an array of problems that are more substantial than libraries. But why would lawmakers and the governor go here when they have so many other things on their menu of wish items?
Yeah, well, it's part of that, you got the majority, go for it kind of a strategy there. I'm not sure how well those kinds of things are going to succeed or even get out of committee when we look at past history, those kinds of measures. The thing is, for a number of people, that there are certain things that have been pent up over the last 4 or 8 years that they've wanted to forward. Some of that we saw in the previous legislatures that didn't go anywhere, or if it did, it found itself on the short end of a veto. And now, as you spoke of this new openness to these ideas that is felt out there with a number of these legislators, time to go for it, time to try to get everything out there. You get to a point where it is difficult to get everything that everybody wants, even if it's stuff that the majority would like, just try and get it through there. I mean, one thing that has surprised me so far is the almost total inactivity on a number of bills that deal with labor issues, specifically collective bargaining. Those measures haven't moved at all, and there are several, and some would be fairly substantive in what they do, but there's just been no movement, and probably because there is a leadership in the legislature know, they have to make up a priority list about what things are important, of course, consulting with the governor since they're of the same party. And, you know, some things there are going to be a priority and some things are not. And at this point, I'm not sure that those issues are going to be a priority compared to the many others that you suggested.
Well, another bill, writes the Advocate, would threaten librarians with potential prison time for seeking reimbursement for professional training through the American Library Association, whose policy some conservatives have assailed. House Bill 777 by State Representative Kelly Dickerson of Denham Springs has not been scheduled for a hearing. And Kelly Dickerson was known as Kelly Hennessy when she was an on-air personality here in Baton Rouge. And at one time, she was a co-host of a program with Scott Rogers, who had his problems, as we know. 877-217-5757, back after this. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana, and our guest for a few more minutes is Professor Jeff Saddo, longtime professor of political science at LSU Shreveport, and later in the hour we will hear from John McClendon, the noted defense attorney in Baton Rouge, and he will opine about former President Trump's legal woes. He's now on trial in a criminal courtroom in New York City, and he is the Republican nominee to be with the election getting closer and closer. I believe it's 29 weeks from today, if my math is correct. So we are getting very close, and Trump could be in a courtroom for a few months, and the nature of the beast is he has to be there. And just from a time perspective, if nothing else, that makes it tricky with the election on November 5th. So we're just 6.5 months away from the finish line. That's after the conventions, the whole shebang. And this case, as we've talked with Jeff and others, involves a Baton Rougean and Stormy Daniels, who it has been acknowledged was paid $130,000. Michael Cohen, who also will testify against the former president, his one-time attorney, who has served time for prison himself for crimes related to this, he will testify, and I'm sure he will say, at least I fully believe he will say, that he was pretty much ordered to do this by his client, Donald Trump, and he willingly complied and broke the law, and by virtue of that, he's going to say the former president broke the law, and a jury in New York City will determine whether or not President Trump, former President Trump, is culpable. But Jeff Saddo, some have speculated that even if he were convicted, which of course would be the worst case scenario for Mr. Trump, he would be on appeal, so it would not negate him from seeking the office of president. He could be elected. He could actually serve from a prison cell if it had to be that way. But nonetheless, he can turn this into a fundraising mechanism, and he could, even if convicted, according to some, come across as a martyr of sorts. How do you think this will play with the public at large, with the electorate?
Well, it's pretty complex. You do point out the dynamics that, and it's kind of been the case with Trump throughout his political career is, whenever attacked in some way, shape, form, or fashion, that doesn't really seem to erode his support. It only tends to strengthen it. But, you know, on the other hand, you have Democrats out there in the Biden campaign that would just love to, put the word convict next to Trump's name. Whether there's appeal or whatever, they'd love to have that out there. And certainly polling gives them a little hope in the sense that when pollsters have been asking the question, who would you vote for today? But then who would you vote for if Trump were convicted? Something like that. His support drops by a point or two, and that may not be a whole lot. But again, close election is everyone seems to think it's going to be again, third time in a row. That could make a difference. There's some stakes, quite considerable stakes out here when you're looking at it just from the perspective of a campaign, other legal questions and precedents aside.
Well, the other day I added up all the states that Hillary Clinton won, which Biden would be expected to win, even though his polling numbers have not been real strong. And then he would need to carry some other states, obviously, because Hillary Clinton did not win the election. And James Carville has said if he carries Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, that would be the difference. Well, it really comes down to those states in Nebraska and Maine and those congressional districts. And remember, Democrats have been getting one vote out of Nebraska, and Republicans have been getting one vote out of Maine. And if that were to stay that way, and the election was as Carville perhaps anticipates, with Biden carrying Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and Trump winning in Georgia, North Carolina, Nevada, and Arizona, then the vote would be 269 to 269, meaning it would go to the House of Representatives, and it would be the current House, not the newly elected House. And wouldn't that be something, Professor Sato, if Mike Johnson, pride of Shreveport, Louisiana, Benton, Louisiana, determined who the next president of the United States is?
Yeah, it's a little more complicated than that, because in the House of Representatives, you actually vote by delegation. You don't do individual votes. So I haven't checked lately, but I think the balance is something like 28 state delegations would be expected to vote for. There's a few ties in there. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's like 28 Republican, 22 Democrat, or something like that. So, apparently, I think we would expect the Republicans to vote for their party and Democrats are there. So I think, Trump gets it under that particular scenario. But, lots of stuff going on there. I mean, talk about Nebraska making this last-minute switch to away from single district apportionment, along with their two statewide votes, and make it all statewide, just like everybody else but Maine. So maybe that'll change.
Well, are they going to do that?
There are bills to
there
do
are bills,
that in
Nebraska. But yeah, whether yeah, it happens but, is subject to conjecture.
Yeah, although really, it appears time is more the enemy than will. The will seems to be there, just the timing just may not.
But that would actually benefit Trump, because we know he's going to win Nebraska. Okay, yeah. James and Metairie's been waiting patiently. James, I want to get you in before we part company with Mr. Sato. Go for it, Mr. James and Metairie.
Hey, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Mr. Sato. If anybody needed any evidence that Jeff Landry was nothing but a cheap demagogue, last year, before a group of pastors, who, by the way, very, very powerful special interest group, they're trying to get free advertising in our schools by posting the Ten Commandments.
What's the question?
My question to Mr. Sato is, Jeff Landry said that Satan is...
That Satan is what?
Sit.
What is Satan?
The libraries...
I can't... You're fading in and out.
Satan so. Sit. Now, Mr. Sato, do you believe that Satan is in our libraries?
Some of us believe Satan's everywhere.
Yes, precisely. You're a good Catholic, yes. That's a problem, but yes.
There are forces of good and evil, and I think they're everywhere, James. So I'll give the governor a pass on this. Some other things, he's probably due for some scrutiny, but on this, he's okay. Jeff Sato, thank you, and always a pleasure to talk with you.
Sure.
And before we hit the break, let's hear a bit from Jackie Stern, who is part of a group called Jews Against Gassing. This is Jim Inkster, and we're joined by Jackie Stern now. She is a longtime advocate in New Orleans, executive board member of the Jewish Federation of Greater New Orleans, and she is one of the organizers of a group called Jews Against Gassing. It's a coalition of Jewish organizations, faith leaders, and individuals in the community from across Louisiana seeking the removal of the gassing alternative method of execution from the law. And a bill has been sponsored by Katrina Jackson to not have this as a potential method of execution in Louisiana. And Jackie Stern, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And this bill, Senate Bill 430, will be heard today if things go according to plan. But at 12 o'clock, there will be a rally on the front steps of the state capitol. And tell us about who will be there and why you believe this is of grave importance.
At the press conference itself, which is at noon, we will have people from over the state, throughout the state there, representing Jews Against Gassing, and people from New Orleans also. And it will be a presentation of what we believe is going on for us with this, which is that we are really very against gassing as a method of execution in our state.
Well, approximately 2.7 million Jews were killed by gas at the Nazis' concentration camps, and the historical association for this method is no doubt chilling and undeniable. And
okay, we're going to take a short break, and we will return with Jackie after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and a reminder that this is a day in which we ask for your support for WRKF, and it's a special day for new people, donors who've never given. It's the $2 Tuesday special, $2 a month, and you're in the membership camp and become a shareholder in WRKF, which has stood tall and proud in public radio for 44 years in the Capital Region. You can give more if you want, and we would like it if you can go to 5 or 10 or 15 or even more. But $2 a month is all that's needed to support WRKF. Please give us a call. And if you like this hour of programming, we want to hear from you right now at 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753. And we're going to pick up, this was obviously a taped interview before the show with Jackie Stern, who's getting ready for the noon rally at the Capitol. She's part of a group called Jews Against Gassing, and she was explaining why people of the Jewish tradition in particular, based on what happened in Nazi Germany, have an aversion to this type of execution and believe it's cruel and unusual and a reminder of a nefarious and notorious past that we'd like to put to rest. Here's Jackie.
From what we understand, it did not go well. It was what I would call almost a botched kind of way of trying to exterminate a person.
She's talking about the execution.
Well, it's known
in Alabama
as nitrogen hypoxia or nitrogen suffocation. And obviously, it is a brutal way to die. There's no easy way, but there are ways that might not be considered cruel and unusual. And I would suspect there are people in court right now making the case that it is cruel and unusual punishment.
That's correct.
Hearing the voice of Jackie Stern, who's one of the organizers of Jews Against Gassing, and there will be a rally at noon today at the state capitol. So, have you talked to lawmakers? Do you have any feel on how they are assessing this particular method and the legislation that would do away with it, potentially?
Yes, we have been speaking to lawmakers. We've been at the Capitol frequently in the last few weeks, and I feel that we have at least the ear of quite a number of them. I think for my feeling, my impression is that almost for everybody, whether you're Jewish or not, or whether you have a disabled child or someone in your family who would not fit the stereotype of Nazi Germany, that this brings up a terrible association for many people, including the lawmakers, I think.
We will follow this with you, Jackie, and thanks for your time and coming in just a few hours, as in noon, at the Capitol, members and Jewish faith leaders of the newly formed group Jews Against Gassing will gather on the steps in Baton Rouge to voice support for Senate Bill 430, which removes this method of execution.
And thanks to Jackie Stern. And we're joined now in studio by one of the most able defense attorneys in Louisiana. He knows his way around a criminal courtroom, John McClendon. And in New York City, the eyes of the world are on a courtroom in the heart of Manhattan. The historic hush money trial of Donald John Trump got underway yesterday with an
arduous process of selecting a jury to hear the case charging the former president with falsifying business records in an effort purportedly to stifle stories about his sex life with Stormy Daniels, the adult film star from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The day ended without any jurors being chosen. The selection process is resuming today. And the president, former president, is in some legal peril, and he's in a venue that has not been kind to him in previous legal skirmishes. He's lost twice to E. Jean Carroll in a courtroom on a sexual assault allegation in civil court. Now it's criminal court, which means that worst-case scenario, if he were convicted, he could go to jail for this. And believe it or not, he could serve as a president of the United States from a jail cell. And even if he's convicted, I'm sure he will appeal, and he will be a convicted felon on appeal if he is convicted. But as we know, in America, in New York City, in this particular case, you got to get all the jurors to agree. And it only takes one person to hold it up. And I think Donald Trump knows that he's not going to be acquitted in this, but he could have a hung jury, which for him would be a victory. But he says it's a scam, it's a political witch hunt, it continues and it continues forever. That's what he said after exiting the courtroom. John McClendon, I would imagine representing Donald Trump would be a legal challenge that many lawyers would relish. But on the other hand, you got a client who is real hard to control. What do you make of this?
Yeah, that would be the most difficult part, is trying to get your client to be quiet and stop talking. But you know what he's doing is he's sending out emails raising funds all day yesterday. I read in the New York Times that he is he's using this to raise money and to rally his base.
And effectively so.
Yes.
And there are people who believe in him, and because of that, they're probably tilted to believe anything he says, despite evidence to the contrary. And there are those who say the evidence in this case is overwhelming. The guy who's a star witness, who is his lawyer, his top lawyer, Michael Cohen's already gone to jail for this. And he says he didn't do this on his own. He obviously, according to him, had some consent with his client, Donald Trump, and it is a complex case. It's more than just a simple paying somebody to be quiet. It's using elaborate methods, and all of this will be on display. How difficult will it be to present this to a jury?
I think from the prosecution side, that obviously their main witness is going to be Michael Cohen, and he'll give basically firsthand account of what happened. However, the defense is going to paint him as a convicted felon. Cannot be trusted. The money allegedly went directly from Michael Cohen to Stormy Daniels. There's no way I can predict anything. It is, unlike his case in Florida, where you and I talked about before, that's a big Republican. That jury veneer down there would be heavily Republican.
And a judge also appointed by Trump, who appears to be in his camp. So,
but up here, you got a heavily, Democrat population. However, Trump's from New York. I tell you, the most interesting thing I read yesterday was, of the first 96 jurors brought in, 50 of them said they could not be fair. They got rid of half of the jury pool yesterday. It didn't say why they couldn't be fair, but I found that astounding. It's going to take them a long time to pick this jury.
And that's all it takes to get off a jury. And, yeah, of course, as we know, some people don't want to be on that jury.
Well, I was talking about that yesterday. Most people don't want to be on a jury. Most people do anything to get out of jury duty. They'll say anything. They just don't want to do it, which is a shame, really, because everyone I've ever talked to that serves on a jury end up loving the experience. But in this case, you might find a stealth juror that really wants to get on that jury and can say, oh, yeah, I can be fair.
A person could become famous if they're the one rogue holdout.
That's right. Think about OJ, who just died. Some of his jurors end up writing books and being interviewed and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, but we're not going to have jury nullification here. I think we're going to have a juror in which largely they will accept the prosecution's claim that Mr. Trump violated the law, but there might be one or two who decide otherwise, and a hung jury is essentially a victory for former President Trump. He leaves the courtroom as a free man and not a convicted felon, And I would think based on that, he would really raise some money.
Oh, yeah. And again, it would energize his base. And if he gets a hung jury, I doubt the district attorney would try him again. You know, they have the option. They could try
him a second
time.
Well, we saw that with Edwin Edwards, remember?
Right.
And there was an 11-1 vote for acquittal, and John Voltz went for the gold the second time, and it didn't work. And, it is hard to convict a person of the consequence of Donald Trump. And I think almost every lawyer, and I'm going to ask John this, would say, do not take the stand. Yeah. Do not take the stand, but he says he's going to. That's what he says.
I would strongly advise him not to take the stand. But again, he's Donald Trump, you know, because a prosecutor could pick him apart. That would be a very bad idea, in my opinion. But he might, you know. Has he said it? I didn't read that he said he was going to take the stand.
He says he's going to take the stand. That's what he says.
I'm interested in the next few days of watching what the questions for voir dire, you know, the picking of the jury. I read yesterday they're not allowed to ask, did you donate money? Who did you vote for? Who are you going to vote for? But I think fair questions are, have you ever attended a Trump rally? I think that's a fair question. Or a Biden rally. Do you think the election was stolen or rigged? I think those are all fair questions. So this the jury selection is going to be almost as interesting as the trial.
I was commenting yesterday to somebody when I was a little kid. You could tell any number of things about a person by asking them what they thought of Muhammad Ali. And the same is true of Trump. If you ask them what they think of Trump, you can find out a lot about him. And my friend Foster Campbell said, and of course he's in Trump territory, he said, people say constantly, I don't like him, but I like his policies, which is translated, I like him a whole lot. And and we ran into this with David Duke. And one of these polls, remember, Trump generally underpolls because some people don't want to tell a pollster they're for him. So if he's leading in a poll, and right now he is still leading, that means Biden's got some ground to make up.
Yeah. You know what I don't understand in this case is why did he have to pay hush money? I mean, I don't think it was any big secret that Donald Trump slept around. I mean, why did he have to try? Maybe it was in 2016, he was worried about the election, but
it was his wife, maybe. His wife was at home with their infant son, and he's cavorting, and according to Stormy Daniels, having unprotected sex with a porn star.
Yeah, but I mean, Trump went on Howard Stern years back and bragged about the number of women he slept with. It wasn't
and said that not getting venereal disease was his version of Vietnam.
Yeah,
he said that.
So why pay her hush money? Why not just say, yeah, I had an affair with Stormy Daniels. So what? I mean, that struck me as strange. It wasn't a big secret that Donald Trump slept around. So
we'll spend a few more minutes with the remarkable John McClendon, 877-217-5757, back after this. This is Jim Inkster. We're spending a few more minutes with John McClendon, the noted attorney from Baton Rouge and former president of the United States, has become the first of our 45 people who have been president to be in a courtroom in a criminal proceeding, and he is charged with violating the law, concealing hush money payments of $130,000 to adult film star Stephanie Clifford, better known as Stormy Daniels. Now, Trump, former President Trump, is violating rules and recommendations and edicts from the court not to speak his mind, but he's calling Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels, the two presumed star witnesses, two sleazebags who have, with their lies and misrepresentations, cost our country dearly. Now, he could benefit by provoking a mistrial.
Yeah, I was talking to some guys yesterday, and there's a school of thought out there that he could take the stand and say something so outrageous or something that the judge told him was off limits that the jury cannot hear and say it and get a mistrial, which would be great for him because then the next trial would clearly be after the election.
One thing I did agree with him, he said trials are often won in the jury selection process, and the potential jurors are being asked 42 questions about their backgrounds, hobbies, news habits, whether they hold strong beliefs about Donald Trump that would prevent them from being impartial. As you note, 50 of them yesterday, 50 prospective jurors said, yes, they have strong beliefs and that they cannot fairly judge Mr. Trump. And this is in his hometown, and it is ironic that in the place where they know him best, Other than Washington, D.C., he performed more poorly in Manhattan than any other place in the United States of America. Isn't that something?
Yeah, but you know what? The 50 didn't say why they couldn't be fair. I think the question was, can you be fair? How do you know they're saying, they can well, I can't be fair because I think Trump's the greatest thing ever?
But you know, I think if somebody were in that position, they would be more likely to conceal it. They probably would want to get on the jury. That's why that's why they got to be careful about who they choose.
Yeah, but I still maintain that most people do not want to be on a jury. This one's going to be, what'd they say, could be 6 weeks long. There's not that many people that can come to jury trial for 6 weeks.
And he has to sit there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's that's pretty interesting. He has to sit there for 6 weeks. But again, like I said earlier, he'll have emails going out every day. He'll be raising money while he does that. But, you know, he won't be on the campaign trail.
Well, thank you, John McClendon. Yep. Always a pleasure, and we'll follow this with you. Fritz Peterson, a pitcher for the New York Yankees, who was infamous for other reasons. He was a stalwart for the ineffectual Yankees of the 60s and 70s, but he was better known for swapping wives with his teammate, fellow pitcher Mike Kekich. And Peterson was a guy who, a few years ago, surprisingly, when I called him, got his number, he agreed to talk about that time more than 50 years ago, when it was the talk of New York and the country, the two Yankee pitchers were swapping wives, making it reminiscent of the movie Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. But Fritz Peterson was an excellent pitcher, and he, shall we say, was a good sport when I asked him about his life and times. Let's go to the tape.
1973, this was after the film Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, and things were kind of wild and crazy in the early 70s, but you managed to make some big headlines in St. Petersburg in 1973. Mike Kekich, he was your good friend, right? You had pitched
right
with him on the Yankees for a few years.
Right.
How did you and your then-wife Marilyn meet Mike and Susan?
Right. We met them when Mike got traded over to the Yankees in 1969. And we were approximately the same age. We had kids that were approximately the same age, and it made it natural on off days and things like that to get together. And none of us had any idea that this was going to happen. It's just that we were very, very good friends, obviously, not that good yet, but we went to a party one night at Maury Allen's house, a sports writer. And Mike and his wife, Susan, drove separate cars, and I drove a separate car with my wife, and we ended up at Maury Allen's at the same time. So we went in one car after another, and then we went up and had a real nice party, dinner party, hamburgers, hot dogs, beer, wine, whatever. And the night was getting rather risque, not sex stuff, but just fun stuff and friendly stuff. And all of a sudden, I touched Susan's foot by mistake under the table. She was sitting right across from me. And then a couple minutes later, and we don't know who did this, but the other person touched the other person's foot. And that was kind of like a sign that there was more than just infatuation there. And I'm not condoning this by any means, but I'm just telling you what happened. And then so the party went on, and after it was over, we were walking out of Maury's house and walking down to our cars that were parked on the street. And I saw my wife walking close to Mike, and I said, Marilyn, why don't you go home, or not go home, but go to the diner with Mike in his car. We were at a Fort Lee diner in New Jersey. And I said, I'll take Susan in my car, and we'll meet you guys down there and then go home from there. And oddly enough, and I didn't ever think my wife would even want to do that because she was pretty conservative, she said, okay. So we did that. And in that 45-minute period, all of us felt so comfortable being able to talk to the other spouse like that and just felt like there was something there. And it felt like there was something we were missing in our life with the other one, our original ones. And so after that, the next day, Mike and I were at the ballpark talking. And he said to me, he said, hey, that was really fun. You want to do that again? And I said, sure. So we called the wives on the clubhouse phone down in the trainer's room. And we said, you guys want to do that again tonight? So they did, too. So we went out to a place called the Steak and Ale in Fort Lee, and we went out that next night and had a nice meal and some drinks. And then Mike and my wife went off driving in the car talking or whatever. And Susan and I just stayed there just laughing and being ourselves and being finally free to not have somebody say, hey, you said this wrong, you said that wrong. And we had been so controlled before that it was just like we got out of jail. And not saying that they're the jailers, but and they had a similar time, not about the control issue, but just having fun together. And so it kept on going from there toward to the rest of the season until the season ended. And it was time for Mike and Susan to go back out to Montana where they live. And I didn't want them to go. I didn't. My wife, Marilyn, kind of didn't want them to go. I'm sure Susan didn't want to leave. And I'm sure Mike was on the fence, too. And this, we went on with the original people for like the next month trying to see if there was anything left of our marriages. And one night I was doing hockey color with John Sterling for the New York Raiders hockey team in those days. And we were on a flight from the Philadelphia to Boston. And it was one of those knuckleball special flights where everybody's scared and white-knuckled and all that. And I thought to myself, you know what? I don't care if this plane goes down or not, because I didn't have Susan with me, and I determined after that and the next day to call Mike and say, Mike, do you want to go ahead with this? And he said, yes.
All right. We're going to return in 2 minutes with Fritz Peterson. What an amazing story. And he is still together with the former Susan Kekich 42 years later. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
All right, we're not 2 minutes. We're going to do it right now because this is taped. It was 2 minutes then, but here's Fritz Peterson.
Our guest for a while longer is Fritz Peterson, the former New York Yankees southpaw ace, 20-game winner and an all-star in 1970, and a man who has the lowest earned run average in the history of Yankee Stadium, 2.5 to 133 career victories. Three very good books that he has penned, and now at the age of 73, there's a movie that is forthcoming about the situation that he was detailing as we went to the break regarding his love for the wife of a teammate. Mike Kekich was married to Susan. Fritz was married to Marilyn, and they fell in love with each other's wives, and in 1973, they make the decision to essentially take the other's wife as their own. So you make this decision, and how did the New York Yankees respond to it?
Well, the Yankees responded pretty well, the players, and the manager, Ralph Houk, did, and even the general manager, Lee McPhail, did. Lee, not a joking man, said, I think we may have to call family day off this year because he saw the big picture, and that part was pretty good. The fans, depending on where the fans were, reacted accordingly. At first, the first time I came out in the public and pitched was in St. Petersburg, which is the Mets stadium in spring training. And when they heard my name, they gave me not one, not two, but three standing room boos, unloading all their closets on me out in the field. So it was quite a surprise. And Lou Gehrig said this was the luckiest day in his life about the day standing up in Yankee Stadium. This was about the unluckiest day in my life.
All right, so that was Fritz Peterson, who died over the weekend. Had a full life, shall we say, and he and Susan, the former Susan Kekich, they stayed together. Marilyn and Mike Kekich did not. In fact, they had a broken engagement, but it was a true love story between Susan and Fritz. She ended up having three more kids after having two with Mike. She had three with Fritz, and she survives him. He lived to be 82 years old. And a reminder that there is still time all day long to get in 2 o'clock Tuesday or $2 Tuesday, $2. So for $24 a year, you can be on the membership rolls of WRKF, and we recommend that you do that. If you are capable, please give us a call, 855-893-9753. That's 855-893-9753. Until tomorrow, stay safe and stay tuned.